Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the story of the women who took to the streets, went to jail, even endured physical abuse and hunger strikes with one goal in mind, the right to vote. We'll spend this hour with filmmaker Michelle Ferrari, whose two-part American Experience documentary looks at the seven-decade struggle by American women before the 19th Amendment was ratified. We'll talk about how U.S. activists were influenced and sometimes appalled by the radical tactics of voting rights crusaders in England, and about how Black women's contributions to the campaign were sidelined to the detriment of the movement. Our conversation starts after a short break. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony are famous for their crusade to secure American women's right to vote. But a literal lifetime passed between the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848 and the ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920. And not one of those founding mothers of American women's suffrage lived to see it happen. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Fortunately for all of us, first-generation crusaders for women's rights passed down the fight to their daughters and their granddaughters, who took up the struggle with equal enthusiasm despite pervasive sexism from outside the movement and insidious racism within it. Michelle Ferrari knows this story well. She is writer, director, and producer of the two-part American Experience documentary, The Vote, which premieres tonight on PBS. We're delighted to have her here to talk about it. Michelle, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris. I'm delighted to be here.
The conventional way to describe women's acquisition of voting rights is to say we were given the right to vote. One of your interview subjects notes at the very start, nothing was given. Women had to take the right to vote.
Yeah, it's practically an axiom of American history, right? In 1920, the 19th Amendment gave or granted women the right to vote. And in my view, so seldom has an axiom so thoroughly obscured reality. It took 72 years, as you noted, three generations of women, and a fight that went on decade after decade after decade until women actually won the vote. And I think it's really important that that be understood.
How had those earliest champions of voting for women come together at Seneca Falls, and why did it happen in 1848?
Well, there had been rumblings about women's rights for some time by 1848. Most of the women who were involved in the women's rights movements were also abolitionists. And I think they came not only to understand their subjugation in reference to slavery, but also to begin to learn a way to address it politically via the abolitionist movement. So for many years, the two causes were entwined, and abolitionist women were very often also working for women's rights.
You remind us in the film that in the mid-19th century, married women in America had almost no legal rights. What sort of control did the law give women's husbands over their affairs?
Basically, in the 19th century, a married woman was, under the law, absorbed into the person of her husband, which meant basically that she could not go out to work. If she did go out to work with her husband's permission, the wages went to her husband. If she dared to divorce, husbands retained custody of the children. Women were barred from public universities. They were just generally second-class citizens, if citizens at all.
So the list of demands that came out of Seneca Falls was something known as the Declaration of Sentiments. Interestingly, the demand for women's right to vote did not pass unanimously. Why was that controversial, even among women agitating for independent legal standing?
Now, most of the declarations were socially acceptable. The idea of women entering the public sphere and voting was considered a particularly dirty realm of the public sphere was anathema. There were many, many arguments against women's suffrage. Women weren't intelligent enough. They would destroy the home. They would vote the way their husbands and fathers did, so there was no point. But it was thought to be ludicrous. I mean, Lucretia Mott said to Elizabeth Cady Stanton, "Oh, if you're going to put that demand in there that we pursue suffrage, you'll make us ridiculous. Huh. And indeed, they were made fun of relentlessly in the press for having done so.
A generation later in 1869, the 15th Amendment would have seemed the perfect opportunity to extend the franchise to women, but it limited voting rights to black men, arguably only in name, for a very long time. But were there serious discussions in Congress around the time of the 15th Amendment about letting women vote?
I don't know that I would call them serious conversations. I mean, there were definitely efforts to get that language into the 15th Amendment, to have sex be one of the words in the constitutional amendment. But I think really from the beginning, it was pretty clear that the congressional Republicans didn't think that both measures would go through. And it should be pointed out that, you know, Republicans at this point were the party of Lincoln and Democrats were the party of white supremacy. I find that in this day and age, it's hard for people to grasp that. In any event, so congressional Republicans come back to abolitionists, to the American Equal Rights Association, and say, you know what, the nation can't swallow these two reforms at once. Hmm. They can't handle black men getting the vote and women getting the vote at the same time. And this provokes a real split in what had been a pretty effective, if not always easy, coalition.
How vocal were the male allies that existed for women's suffrage in their support for women's right to vote?
Some of them were very vocal. I mean, Frederick Douglass, after the 1848 convention at Seneca Falls, published an editorial on the front page of his newspaper, the North Star, endorsing rights, voting rights for women. There were other men along the way who were very vocal in their support of women's suffrage. But by and large, I would say men were the biggest obstacle to the effort.
And a couple of decades later, Susan B. Anthony specifically asked Frederick Douglass to stay away from a voting rights event.
Well, by the time we get to the 1870s, you know, the 14th and 15th Amendments have passed. This split has occurred within the movement. And, you know, for a while, it wasn't a split along racial lines. It was a split having more to do with strategy. And one group believed that it was more appropriate to seek voting rights from the states to change state constitutions because our national constitution actually leaves voting rights to the states. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were still hopeful that they could get an amendment passed for women. And but by that point, Jim Crow was on the rise in the South. And the Southern states were going to great lengths to keep newly enfranchised black men from voting. And Susan B. Anthony and other white suffragists decided that it was expedient in their best interest to accommodate those white supremacists and to sideline their black allies and supporters. I think, you know, Susan B. Anthony believed that once white women got the vote, they would extend it to everyone, but it nevertheless, I can't find the word I want, but, you know, it nevertheless maintained the status quo.
Ida B. Wells was another person who was sidelined, and she's such a heroine, I'm sure, to you and I both as journalists. Can you talk a little bit about her and how she got committed to this cause and why she sort of stuck with it even when she was quite literally made to march at the back of parades?
Well, she refused to march at the back of the parade, which I think says everything about her. She told the women who told her to march in the back that she would rather not participate at all. You know, she's a fierce, incredibly fierce advocate for black rights, you know, best known as an anti-lynching crusader who really, really went out on a limb in exposing the true causes of lynching in the South and made herself well and truly hated. She was chased out of town and her newspaper office was burned to the ground. And, you know, I think she was very clear about the fact that voting rights represent, and the ability to actually employ them, represented a real source of power. And without it, African Americans had very little hope of protecting themselves.
Can you talk a little bit about the things that men were afraid would happen if women were allowed to cast ballots?
Oh, gosh. They were afraid they would be left with the children and the laundry. They were afraid that no one would be at home to make dinner. They were afraid, essentially, that the family would come unraveled. So, I mean, this is not surprising, right? The United States was a patriarchy at that point. Women's roles were very, very rigidly constrained. And they were supposed to be in the home. Women were supposed to be in the home, raising the family, taking care of the husband, taking care of the children. That was their role. And this seemed like voting seemed like a very dangerous breach of that sphere.
It's interesting to think about the way that men were afraid. I mean, obviously that signifies the fact that they understood that if given a choice, no one would want to exclusively be forced to follow those roles. I mean, lots of women do both today. They engage in the world and vote and work, and they also have important roles at home. But men clearly understood that unless they kept it legal, women wouldn't just stand for being second-class citizens.
I think that's part of it. And I think it's also just a jealous guarding of power. They were afraid of what women would do if given the ballot. You know, many of the arguments for women suffrage, particularly in the progressive era in the early 20th century, had to do with the ways in which women were going to clean up American society. They were going to clean up corruption in politics. They were going to, get rid of exploitation in industry. They would get rid of child labor. They would get rid of the exploitation that women faced. There was a lot of links to prohibition and temperance. So they would shut down drinking or at least curtail the excessive drinking. And a lot of men didn't want that, particularly people who are profiting from it.
Was there a lot of formal overlap between the temperance movement and the voting rights movement?
Indeed, there was. The temperance movement gave women in the late 19th century a way to be out and about, a socially acceptable way to engage with the public sphere. And many, many women did. And many women had, a genuine gripe about alcohol because men would spend their paychecks at the bars, come home drunk, beat the wife and kids, and then there was nothing left for the bills. How are you going to pay the rent and buy food? So many women entered the temperance movement, and Frances Willard, the head of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, endorsed Votes for Women. She regarded it as she said, a ballot, a weapon for home protection. And this created a crossover. So many temperance advocates sort of automatically became suffrage activists.
Why did women suffragists often show up for demonstrations in white dresses? What was the symbolism behind that?
That's an interesting question. They adopted colors to brand the movement as we might do today. Mm. And white was the color. I actually don't have a good answer for that. I don't know why white. They also used yellow and purple to a large extent in the movements, and typically the color of suffrage was yellow. So you had a scene in one American city where the suffragists created a gauntlet as politicians were going to and fro a convention in St. Louis, and they were all holding suffrage yellow umbrellas. Hmm. But everyone always dressed in white.
My guest is writer, director, and producer Michelle Ferrari. She's the filmmaker responsible for the two-part, four-hour American Experience documentary, The Vote, airs tonight and tomorrow on PBS. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer, director, and producer Michelle Ferrari about her two-part American Experience documentary, The Vote. It airs tonight on PBS. Michelle, I think listeners may be less familiar with women's suffrage efforts elsewhere in the world. There are some parallels between the voting rights push in the U.S. and the U.K. In the early 20th century, the two most famous British crusaders were a mother-daughter duo named Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst, and I just found them fascinating. What kinds of tactics did they use to get lawmakers' attention?
Yeah, they're really great women. So Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst founded the Women's Social and Political Union in Britain, and this was sort of a militant offshoot of the British suffrage movement. And very soon, they started doing things that would generate attention and also get them arrested. So they're speaking on soapboxes on the street. They're passing out pamphlets. They are going to political meetings and interrupting the politicians and being dragged out of the meetings. And these are all considered extremely unladylike behaviors and really, really put people off. To the extent that a journalist, in an attempt to make fun of them, dubs them suffragettes as opposed to suffragists. It's a way to sort of belittle them.
What did they do with that term, suffragettes? Did they embrace it or did they continue to reject it?
They ultimately embraced it and they started a newspaper that they called the Suffragette, which is great. they became increasingly impatient and increasingly violent. So they began with protests, 10,000 people demanding the right to vote, marches. They got themselves arrested and sent to prison. In prison, they demanded to be treated as political prisoners, and knowing that that demand would not be met. And when it wasn't met, they went on hunger strikes and were force-fed. Later, when you get into the teens, they start planting bombs in the mailboxes of members of parliament and on their doorsteps. They throw acid on golf greens and spell out votes for women in the grass. They slash seats in trains. So it gets quite intense in Britain.
The Pankhursts were a huge influence on this young American woman studying abroad named Alice Paul.
Alice Paul is a super fascinating creature. I think the thing that interests me, that I found most fascinating about her is, okay, so she's a Quaker, right? She grows up in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And she says, although she had Irish maids, she says that in her life, she never really met anyone who wasn't a Quaker in her young life. And Quakers believe that everyone is equal in the eyes of God, and girls and boys are educated equally. She got the same education that her brother did. And she graduates from college, and she goes off to Britain, to England, to do graduate work. She's studying graduate economics, first woman ever to enroll in this class at Birmingham University, and she becomes involved with the Pankhursts, and she spends the better part of a year working with them and marching with them and street speaking on their behalf, which I find really interesting because she wasn't a citizen of England. She wasn't going to end this fight with the right to vote. She was literally agitating on other women's behalf. Which I think says something about her single-mindedness and zealotry and the way in which she's willing to rise to a cause.
She would spend a lot of time in England and also later in the U.S. in jail for her activism. How did she try to use those arrests to bring more attention to the cause?
Well, she learned this tactic from the Pankhursts: declare yourself a political prisoner once arrested, and when they turn you down, go on a hunger strike. And a hunger strike is a way to, get media attention for the cause. And, the original hope was that it would get women released from prison more quickly because nobody wants a starving suffragist on their hands. But it also was a tactic designed to attract media attention. So she brings this tactic back to the United States, and in fact, it does attract media attention. And at the point in the struggle where she uses it, which is quite late, 1918, she does bring a lot of eyes to suffrage at a crucial moment, and a lot of sympathy for the cause.
The force feeding that Alice Paul and other suffragists were subjected to when they engaged in hunger strikes in jail, I mean, they were not kidding around. This is not just being forced to, like, take a bite of food. This was very, they were basically held down and had tubes shoved down their throats?
Yeah, either down their throats or up their nose. Lucy Burns, Alice Paul's second in command, wrote about bleeding profusely from the nose after being force-fed. Yes, so they force tube down one way or the other, and then they pour in a mixture of milk and eggs to keep the woman alive. And obviously, it's cold liquid. It produces a lot of retching. They did indeed have to be tied down or held down. Alice Paul described it as being an animal about to be vivisected.
Hmm. Do we know anything? I imagine, Michelle, in the early 20th century, women were not included in political polling. I'm curious as to how sort of average American women who maybe weren't actively participating in suffrage demonstrations, how they felt about the idea that they were denied the right to vote.
You know, it's a really good question. I don't think I have a good answer for it because their feelings were not recorded. I think it's safe to say, or at least the journalists of the time believed, that there was a group of women who were ardently in favor of women having the right to vote. And then there was another smaller group of women who was adamantly opposed to women having the right to vote. And probably the vast majority of women didn't have an opinion or didn't know what their opinion was.
Hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, there was this faction of women who were adamantly opposed to granting women the right to vote. They were constantly trotted out by men who opposed giving women the right to vote.
Sure. Well, yeah, they were the perfect poster children. But it's important to note that they organized on their own. They weren't brought together by men. It wasn't like a tool of the patriarchy. These were women who genuinely believed that women should not have the right to vote. They organized themselves. They went around speaking out against women's suffrage, to the delight of women on the other side of the issue who said, well, consistency is a jewel. If a woman's place is in the home, why are you traveling to another city to speak out against suffrage? But, you know, by and large, those women were, they enjoyed a certain amount of class and racial privilege. They genuinely believed that women changed the world in a different way, that their power lay in their influence, their ability to influence the men in their lives, their fathers, their brothers, their sons, their husbands, and that they would lose something if they were plunged into what was then considered the very sordid world of politics.
I don't want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Rhonda is on the line in Murphy, Texas. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, hi. I am a graduate student at SMU in human rights and social justice, and I'm really a voting rights advocate. And I wanted to know, has there ever been a concerted effort between white women and black women to have, let's say, a truth and reconciliation as to why white women opted to go the route that they did that helped prevent black women from voting even after 1920 when the 19th Amendment was passed, and we still didn't get that right to vote until the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Has there ever been a concerted effort?
Thanks so much for calling.
And reconciliation for that.
What do you know about that, Michelle?
I, to my knowledge, there hasn't been. I mean, I think there were some sporadic efforts to address these issues during the second wave feminism, when there were, again, you know, lots of disagreements between black and white activists. But I don't think there's been any, you know, moderated forum in which these issues were aired for all parties.
It's interesting that tensions have persisted even in the feminist movement between black and white activists. A lot of women of color say that white women have tried to sort of run the feminist movement to their exclusion.
Well, it's this issue of intersectionality, right? And so I think, you know, like if you look at the suffrage movement, white women were looking for one thing from the vote, and black women were actually looking for something else. They were looking for that and more. And because white women more easily had the access to the levers of power, it was easy, it was expedient for them to say, hey, let us get this done, and then we'll come to you. And I think that's been a tension that has played out through the 20th century and continues to play out.
You mentioned earlier that different factions of the women's suffrage movement in the United States disagreed over strategy, so that some activists wanted to do it state by state and others preferred to push for a blanket federal policy. Why did that tension exist?
Well, I think we tend to believe as Americans that as citizens, we have the right to vote. And in fact, in the Constitution, in its original form, it says nothing about the right to vote. It leaves voter eligibility to the states. And states are free to define eligibility as they see fit. Now, there are amendments to the Constitution that have, created barriers to broad categories of discrimination. But in the beginning of the fight, there were women suffrage advocates, and women and men, who believed that constitutionally it made more sense to approach states because they, according to the Constitution, had the power to make these decisions. The other faction, which began with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and was later, brought back to life by Alice Paul, really thought this is a silly waste of time, and it's quite clear that many of the states in the Union will never grant women suffrage, so it would be far better to open the constitutional doors and pass something that prohibited states from ever discriminating on the basis of sex.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I know that folks in Wyoming are very proud to have been the first state to write their constitution to guarantee women the right to vote. Three other Western states followed. Why did progress sort of freeze after that in the effort to do this state by state?
Well, I think it's because what you were seeing in the West wasn't really progress, which is to say the Western states that embraced women's suffrage had their own unique local reasons for doing so. Part of it had to do with the fact that the states were very sparsely populated, and including women in the electorate was thought to maybe be an invitation to more women. It's also true that many of these states were trying to establish their relationship with the federal government and against the entrenched power of the eastern states. And so more votes in that sense was an asset because it provided them more representation in Congress and the national government. So there were a lot of local issues being worked out in the extension of suffrage to women, and that those unique circumstances didn't exist elsewhere.
Before women could vote, were they allowed to hold public office or serve on juries?
No.
So I want to talk a little bit about class tensions. How did Harriet Stanton Blatch try bringing working class women into the campaign, and how successful was she in doing that?
Harriet Stanton Blatch is one of my favorite characters, I think because she's this, sort of bridge between the generations. Her biographer, Ellen Du Bois, refers to her as the first second generation feminist, and she has a very, very unique approach to all of these issues. But she, too, had spent time in England. She was married to a British man, and she got to know the Pankhursts and studied their methods, which had to do a lot with adopting the tactics of the working class. And she brought all of that back to New York and tried to revive what then was a pretty paralyzed movement in New York State. And she brought class women and professional women, because at this point women are entering the professions, although it's very difficult for them to actually find work. She brings these women together in an organization she calls the Equality League of Self-Supporting Women, because she understands that women who work need the ballot in a way that women who don't. They're trying to enter professions where there are jobs where they're encountering hostility from men, resentment from men, and you know, often harassment from men. And the only way that they're really going to be able to change their working conditions is if they're able to change the policies that govern these industries.
Help us understand this. Woodrow Wilson was not a real believer in women's suffrage, but he did vote for it when his home state of New Jersey held a referendum. Why was that?
He knew it was going to fail, quite honestly. He knew it was doomed. And so as a progressive politician, a man who had won the presidency on the strength of his progressive agenda, he couldn't say he was against women having voting rights. That would not have played well. So he casts a ballot in a state election, and thereby makes it clear that he's a states' rights man when it comes to suffrage. He has no intention of supporting a constitutional amendment. And he also, you know, was connected enough to New Jersey politics to know that that amendment was going to fail.
Was he willing to meet with suffragists who were campaigning for their rights?
He really had no choice. I mean, they pretty much bombarded him and sent deputations, you know, on a regular basis. And he certainly met with them, but he was always very noncommittal and, you know, talked nice, but never did anything.
My guest is writer, director, and producer Michelle Ferrari. She's the filmmaker responsible for the two-part, four-hour American Experience documentary, The Vote, airs tonight and tomorrow on PBS. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Michelle Ferrari, who is writer, director, and producer of the two-part American Experience documentary, The Vote, that airs starting tonight on PBS. You mentioned, Michelle, that women would demonstrate around the White House when President Wilson was in the White House. This is the kind of thing that happens all the time today for various causes. It wasn't done in the 19-teens.
No, quite the contrary. You know, as the film, as one of the interviewees points out in the film, you know, there'd been one previous protest when Jacob Coxey took, you know, a small army of veterans across the White House grounds to protest the lack of pension payments, and they were arrested, and that was the end of the protest. Alice Paul and the National Woman's Party basically stage a picket at the gates of the White House beginning in January 1917 that goes on for months through the year, virtually through the year. And they protest 6 days a week, rain or shine. You know, by the time the United States gets involved in World War I, the protest becomes really a thorny problem in the sense that these women are not doing their part as patriots by protesting the president.
How did World War I start to change the way Americans thought about the proper roles for women and men?
Well, you know, there's sort of two things going on. On the one hand, you have Carrie Chapman Catt, who is the president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, which by 1917 boasts more than 2 million members. And she is a moderate. She is appalled by Alice Paul's protests and thinks that they will really, really hurt the suffrage movement. And she takes a completely different tact. And she cultivates a relationship with Woodrow Wilson. She makes a friend of him. She is pushing state campaigns with an eye toward a constitutional amendment. So she gets him, she cajoles him into weighing in on those state campaigns, getting states to hold referendum, you know, putting more states in place, creating a political will for a constitutional amendment. And she also, although she's a pacifist, she takes a stand on the war, and she promises, she pledges to Wilson the support of the organization's nearly 2 million members. And then, you know, puts those women to work in a variety of capacities. They're raising, planting food and harvesting food. They're repairing trains. You know, women in huge numbers slipped into factories to take over the work of men who had been drafted. And Carrie Chapman Catt makes sure that the nation knows about this. She's running a press operation in New York, churning out press releases that get sent to the newspapers so that everybody's aware of the work that women are doing for the war effort. So that's on one side, and that's changing opinions of who women are as citizens in one way. And then on the other side, you have Alice Paul, who's protesting, who's using World War I as an occasion basically to personally humiliate the president and to throw his words back at him. You know, how can you say this is a war to make the world safer, democracy, when we're not even a democracy? Can't be a democracy if 20 million American women can't vote. And so, you know, the two efforts kind of explode the notion of woman as retiring domestic creature, for sure.
Is it your sense that both strategies were necessary to get this done?
Absolutely, that is my sense, which I think you can tell from the film. Look, I think protest is essential. You know, protests make noise, which bring attention to a cause, make it part of the national conversation, and that effectively often exerts pressure on decision makers. But it's tricky. Protest is tricky because it also tends to arouse opposition and to foment backlash, and sometimes even risks ruffling the feathers of friends and allies. I mean, in the election of 1916, Alice Paul was campaigning against the party in power, right? So Democrats held both houses of Congress and the presidency. They're the party in power. So she's campaigning against all Democrats. And that's in spite of the fact that there were many Democratic congressmen and senators from the Western states who at that point were beholden to constituencies who were in favor of women's suffrage, and therefore much more likely to support a constitutional amendment. She's campaigning against them. So that's a form of protest that I'm quite sure did not endear her to those men, right? So given those political realities, so to speak, I think protest isn't enough. I think you also have to have an organized mechanism that's specifically geared toward moving the levers of power. You need people playing the inside game, cultivating and cajoling politicians, as Carrie Chapman Catt did, and literally creating the political will to make change.
I want to be careful in asking you this question, not to imply that I approve of patriarchy, but I am curious about, you know, a lot of these women campaigning for suffrage had male relatives, fathers and husbands who might have supported them, might not have. Do we know anything about the risk women were willing to subject their relationships to in order to get this right?
You know, I can't cite you chapter and verse on that. I'm sure there were a lot of heated conversations around dinner tables. I mean, Elizabeth Cady Stanton's father threatened to disown her if she included a demand for suffrage in her declaration of sentiments. And her husband promised to be out of town for the convention and in fact was. So, you know, I'm quite sure that this upended a lot of relationships, but I don't have actual narrative to impart. I apologize.
Many listeners will remember that the extension of the franchise to women was ultimately recorded as the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. The women who started the fight hoped it would be the 16th.
Yes, yes. It's, going back to the axiom we were discussing at the top of the show, the 19th Amendment gave or granted women the right to vote, makes it sound like an event, right? It's not an event. It's a process. And it's a process that takes us through 72 years of American history. So in making the film, I'm not only looking at the suffrage movement proper, I'm looking at the Civil War and Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow and World War I and Prohibition and the temperance movement. You know, various elections. So it's a sweeping story that takes in the events and the political movements of the better part of a century. It's big, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
How was the 19th Amendment finally drafted? And tell us a little bit about the ratification process.
Well, I mean, this is the thing, right? Like, these women have to keep fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting. So the amendment was drafted and first introduced into the Senate in 1878. And, you know, year after year, give or take, it gets reintroduced by one or another person who supports it. And year after year, it goes nowhere. So finally, by the time we get to 1918, there has been enough progress in the states that you have kind of critical mass in Congress. And by that, I mean just enough votes to pass it. I mean, it only passes the House by 2 votes, and it only passes the Senate by 1. So it's not like there's a broad mandate to give women the right to vote. It comes down to like a vote or two in many of these cases. And then after all of this, you have to take it out to the states for ratification. And 36 states have to ratify this amendment, which is like basically fighting the battle all over again. And it's more than a year effort, and it all comes down to Tennessee, which is a border state. You know, part of it actually supported the Union during the Civil War, but it's still a Southern state, and the Southern states have proven quite recalcitrant on the issue of women's suffrage. So as Elaine Weiss says in the film, it's like it's a terrible place to put all your marbles for the last ratification battle.
So there was this state lawmaker in Tennessee called Harry Burns. What did Harry Burns' mom have to do with Tennessee becoming the final state to ratify the 19th Amendment?
You couldn't have scripted it better, right? Like if it were fiction, you couldn't have scripted it better. So Harry Burns is, you know, the youngest member of the Tennessee legislature. He's from a staunchly anti-suffrage rural district. He's in town for the referenda, and he's being courted by both sides, suffragists and anti-suffragists. And most of the week, he's wearing a red rosebud in his lapel, signaling that he is against women's suffrage. And the things he's saying to the press indicate the same. And his mother, is a suffragist. And she writes him a letter that gets delivered to him the day of the vote. It's delivered to him by a page on the floor of the Congress and of the House. And, it's a letter from his mom. She's asking him to do some shopping for her in the big city and so forth. But she also tells him that she's been reading the papers and noting that he hasn't been supporting the suffragists. And she advises him to be a good boy and help Mrs. Catt.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When you undertake a project like this, Michelle, obviously, you know, there's a triumphant ending, but it takes a long time. I wonder how often just following these stories and following the fights of so many women who started this but didn't even live to see it happen, how often it just makes you angry to be working on it?
You know, I think there's something to that, although I didn't actually ever experience anger. Mm. And I will tell you why. I will tell you why. You know, this project was not my idea. It was a commission. It came to me from my long relationship with American Experience. And I was thrilled to be making it because I majored in American history and I have a graduate degree in American history. And I knew next to nothing about the women's suffrage movement. And so the opportunity to get to learn about something that was, you know, such a huge swath of our history that, as we've discussed several times in this hour, it gets reduced to a very misleading sentence was kind of thrilling. The idea that, you know, it took as long as it did to make change and that the change that was made in the end was somewhat incremental, that makes me quite frantic and angry. I mean, one of Elizabeth Cady Stanton's demands in her Declaration of Sentiments was equal pay for equal work. And we still don't have that. But it also, you know, I think has been a good object lesson for me in like the dynamics of social change and the way in which you really do have to play the long game.
Do you think something like the Equal Rights Amendment will ever happen in this country?
Seems closer to happening now than it ever has. I think it really depends on where we go from here. I think we're in a very precarious and potentially consequential moment. And I think there are a lot of people who would support it. But it would only happen in an America that doesn't look quite like the America we're living in right now.
What do you mean by that?
I think right now there is a lot of, I'm trying to think about how to phrase this. What we see right now, for example, keeping it close to my story and the idea of voting, is quite a lot of voter suppression, you know, as we ramp up to a particularly consequential presidential election. And, you know, I hope that one of the things viewers take away from the film is a renewed sense of the way in which voting actually is an exercise of power, one that should not be taken for granted, and an appreciation of the fact that any effort to keep people from the ballot box generally reflects a deep desire to maintain the status quo.
So we should view that with suspicion when people make it harder rather than easier to exercise the right to vote.
They're afraid of how you're going to vote is the bottom line.
Do you feel like it's necessary for women to sort of consider themselves a common voting bloc? Is it okay that women sit all along the political spectrum in the same way that men do?
I think it's okay because it is what it is, and I don't see it being any other way. I mean, women are individuals first, and they have different experiences and different viewpoints, and I think it's unrealistic to think that they would put their gender ahead of everything else.
Michelle Ferrari is a writer, director, and producer of the two-part, four-hour American Experience documentary, The Vote. It premieres tonight on PBS. Part two airs tomorrow. Michelle, thank you for making time to speak with us.
Thank you. It was so great to talk to you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast free on whatever podcast service you like. Just search for KERA Think or listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.